Thanks for tuning in for the October 5th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals, Neurology, Neurology Genetics, Neurology and Immunology and Inflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice. In our What's Trending segment, you'll hear from legendary musician Peter Frampton about his career and his experience with inclusion body myositis. This week's feature interview is with Dr. Amy So, and it highlights the updated AAN position statement on the ethical issues raised by the high costs of drugs.
Hi, I'm Ted Burns from the University of Virginia. I'm speaking today with Peter Frampton. One reason we're doing this interview is to discuss Peter's experience as a patient with inclusion body myositis. So what I thought we would do is first talk about what it has been like for Peter Frampton dealing with inclusion body myositis, and then a little bit later talk about his musical career, which is a career of many highlights, including his famous live album, Frampton Comes Alive, which was the top-selling album of all time when it was released in 1976, and it remains one of the greatest live rock and roll albums of all time. So, Peter, thank you for joining us. I'd like to first talk about what it's been like for you to be a patient suffering from IBM, especially as you are a guitarist. And so let me start by asking you to tell us about your early symptoms of what would lead to end up being a diagnosis of IBM.
Okay, I think that's a big part of finding out what you have is with IBM. We're a small body of people, unfortunately. Well, that's good, but we don't get people looking at us quite as much as they do with some of the other diseases. That's why I like to speak about it as much as possible. But you don't know what you have to start with. That's the weird thing, is that I was, I guess about 12 years ago, I was on a father-son trip up to Big Sur. And we stayed at the Big Sur Lodge, and we did it up and just played guitars outside on the porch, and we went for nice hikes and stuff. Well, my son hiked up this hill like I used to, and I thought I could, and of course he beat me. And I got to the top, and I said, Julian, I think I'm just getting old. My legs are just not doing what they should be doing. And that was the first sign. And that's when you think, and most people do, I'm just getting old. This is something that, you know, I got to deal with. Well, it's not. But it's very difficult to diagnose at the best of times. And so anyway, we move on through time a couple of years later, and then my legs are getting a little worse. And I'm thinking stuff like, maybe my jeans are too tight. Stuff like that. And then one day, about 10 years ago, I fell on stage. I went to kick a beach ball in an outdoor venue. I went to kick it. My left knee buckled and I went down. I was okay, thank goodness. And got up and played again. But after they lifted me back up, and we all laughed, and we had that, you know, he's fallen and he can't get up, like the commercial. And I found it funny too. You know, it was embarrassing and humiliating, but it was funny, you know. And then, of course, 3 weeks later, it happens again. And we didn't laugh that time. And that's when I had a 10-day break in the tour. I called my doctor. He said, you need to see a neurologist. So he made an appointment. The doctor came and met me at the office, and he went through lots of different tests. And the first thing he did was my finger flexors. And I went with a friend, and he showed me how strong hers were and how weak mine were. And that was, as well as jumping on one foot and then jumping on the other foot, all sorts of different tests he would do. But he basically said, I'm sorry to tell you, but I'm glad to tell you it's not ALS, it's IBM, inclusion body myositis. You need to go and see Dr. Lisa Christopher Stein at Johns Hopkins Myositis Clinic, and they will be your friends. And they have been for many, many years now, and I can't thank them enough. So I am lucky. One of the luckier ones, there's different speeds of progression. And I have very, very slow. So even though it is affecting my fingers right now, I can still play. My legs are the things that are most worrisome.
Right. I have to say, reading your memoir, I was impressed that the neurologist checked finger flexion strength, because that's an easy muscle group to forget about testing. So that was impressive that that was tested at your first visit and that the diagnosis was made so quickly, because it's not always an easy diagnosis to make. It can be very difficult and you really have to think about it.
Yeah, he said it's a very difficult. And then I read up on it and people get misdiagnosed a dozen times before they right. actually find out what it is. Right. So I feel for those people because, you know, the best thing you can do straight away is, he said, all we have right now is exercising, body movement, and to work my muscles as much as I can all the time. So I work out and it's been a boon. And if I don't work out more than, you know, 6 days a week, I know it. And it's been phenomenal for my situation. And I just spoke to Dr. Lisa the other, if I may call her that, that's what I call her. And she said that we have a Peter Frampton research fund at Johns Hopkins that I started on my finale tour in 2019. And so thank you, everybody, for making it a nice nest egg there for a lot of things that we can do, trials and the like. Whatever she wants to do and the team want to do, I'm going to okay it. Obviously, they can use it.
Oh, that's great. That's great to hear. Could we go back to when you were first diagnosed with IBM? And could you think about some of the things that the doctor said that was helpful for you at a time you were receiving such a serious diagnosis? Anything that, if you had the opportunity to be in the room every time somebody was diagnosed with IBM, were there some things that are really critical that should be said that you can think of?
Yes, I having then experienced the onslaught, even though slow, what I can say to you is it's a devastating diagnosis, obviously. You don't want to hear that. But the bottom line is it's life-changing. It's not life-ending. And one can change one's habits. One can work with the problems. And I'm getting a service dog now. It's being trained right now. I'm off to train with my dog after this. And so, yeah, I think that's it, that to inform people that it's something that you can live with. It's going to make life a little bit more difficult, to say the least, at some point. But I think you have to realize that it's not like, okay, I've got to go and get my life in order because I'm not going to be here.
Right. Right. I always teach my residents, or I try to teach my residents, to always find space to talk about what the reasons for hope might be with the serious diagnosis and the plan. What are we going to do now? Even if it's a poorly formed plan, getting that information out whenever you're talking about something serious or breaking the news, for example, about a serious diagnosis.
Absolutely. And when I did go to Johns Hopkins for the muscle biopsy a little bit later for the final diagnosis, I think that when you are with the people that live, they get up every morning and they go to work and they live to find a cure, whether it be cancer, whether it be IBM, ALS, whatever it is. And the passion involved in their plight or of trying to help people is pretty amazing. I applaud all the doctors and nurses that I've worked with and the ones, because that's all they want. They don't have a crutch yet. We have no drug yet. And that's every day they're just hoping for that. And well, me too, but right. I can't tell you how involved and passionate these doctors and nurses are.
Right. We were talking beforehand about a little bit about my cancer diagnosis, and I'll never forget when I was diagnosed. And what I remember is that I was given a few anecdotes that were hopeful, and we had a plan. This is what we're going to do next. And that's what I heard. The rest of it I didn't really hear, but I needed to hear reason to be hopeful and, all right, what are we going to do now? And that was so important.
Yeah, my plan was to book a plane to Johns Hopkins as soon as possible. And that was my plan. And I went and did my plan. You're right. And I look forward to finding out either way what it was. And I just wanted to get on with it. You're right.
And then it became exercise. It sounds like it became a big part of your plan.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. I was a bit of a slob beforehand, but now I have worked out quite a bit in my lifetime. But this is 6 days a week.
Yeah. I read your memoir. I know you are not a slob. Okay. All right. One or two more questions about IBM, and then I have to ask you a couple questions about your musical career. So I have a number of friends who are huge rock and roll aficionados, and they know you first and foremost as a guitarist. Yes, they know your 1976 album, Frampton Comes Alive, and your other albums, but they think of you first and foremost as an incredible guitarist. Do you think your decades of guitar playing might be one reason why your finger flexion strength is better than it is on average for other patients with IBM?
I believe so, yes. And in fact, playing an instrument with one's fingers or typing or piano, anything will really set you up. So even though my legs are faltering now, when I pick up a guitar, my fingers know what to do.
That's incredible.
Thank goodness. And I'm just losing the strength in them. So I've had to come down in a string gauge so they're a little lighter. But at the moment, I seem to be able to play pretty much like I always could. So I'm very thankful for that. But it is worrying. I had someone that asked me to play on a track the other day, a well-known person, I won't say who, and I was honored that they asked me to play on the track. But I had to say to them, I'm going to do this for you because I love your music and I'm a big fan of yours. And thank you for asking. But I have to give you a proviso that if I do it and I don't think it's up to my standard, I'm not going to send it to you because of my fingers. And you know what? After saying that, I came down to my music room and I just hammered it out. And just, it took me a little longer than maybe it would have a few years ago to do it, but it inspired me to play. The fact that they had asked me to play on something. So as long as people still keep asking me and I keep writing and I keep recording and playing every day, I have to play every day just to remind these guys of what they do, you know.
Right. Well, we appreciate it. I know we're running low on time. I just got to ask you a couple questions about your musical career. And I got to start by just saying it's amazing that you and David Bowie, David Jones, I think was his name back then.
Yes.
You and he went to grade school together, and your dad was his favorite teacher, sounds like.
Yes.
And you and Bill Wyman were very good friends, and George Harrison, Ringo Starr, and members of the Stones, so many famous musicians you were friends with early on. I mean, of course, you've been throughout your career, but as a teenager, when you were playing with Hurd and then Humble Pie, it's really amazing the friendships that you forged at such a young age. Any comment about, I don't know, David Bowie or anything?
Yeah, I mean, my father was the head of a huge art department at the, it was a technical high school.
Right.
So, and my father had this huge art department, a whole building. And so they covered everything from fine art to typography to history of architecture, you name it. It was the full gamut, you know. And David and his friend, George Underwood, who I have to mention, it was the three of us.
Okay.
George did the Ziggy Stardust cover. George is a phenomenal fine artist, painter. And David and I and he, my dad one day said, well, you chaps really like this, you know, this rock and roll stuff. Why don't you bring your guitars to school and I'll put them in my office in the morning, and then at lunchtime, you can get your guitars out and you can, what do you call it, jam? And so, yeah, that's, we jammed at school. And then I had been friends with Dave and George up until we lost Dave, and I'm still I speak to George all the time. So it was the three musketeers, basically.
That's incredible. That's incredible. A couple of quick questions and I'll let you go. Do you have a minute to talk about that day in the Bahamas when you wrote both Show Me the Way and Baby, I Love Your Way? Could you quickly tell that anecdote?
Yeah. In those days, you had to do two albums a year, which was a lot.
Yeah.
And tour, you know, so it was a lot of work. So you were either on the road, you were either writing or you were in the studio. So I went down to the Bahamas, borrowed Steve Marriott's cottage from Humble Pie and took an acoustic down and an electric guitar down there. And I was there for 3 weeks. First 2 weeks, I enjoyed imbibing and having a vacation and hanging out with friends and did no work whatsoever. And in the last 8 days, I realized that I needed to get my skates on. And so that first morning of the last week, I got up. I don't know whether it was Special K or Raisin Bran, but I wish I could remember. But I got out of the right side of the bed and picked up my acoustic. And within 20 minutes, I'd come up with the intro and the verse to Show Me the Way. And so I wrote a verse and a chorus lyrically. And I thought, okay, I can always write the next verse a little later. Let's move on. This is a good day. So I thought that's much better than all the other stuff I was writing. So about 4:30 in the afternoon, I'm sitting outside under a palm tree this time on the beach. It was a private beach and my guitar, my boombox, and a legal pad. And as the sun was setting, I started writing Baby, I Love Your Way and wrote the lyrics right there. The lyrics were basically what I was looking at. Shadows grow so long before my eyes, and they're moving across the legal pad, across the page.
Right.
You know, so that's how it started.
Incredible.
It's just, here I am. This is what I'm doing. I'm in love. I miss the person I'm just about to start a relationship with. So that's what it's going to be about. And so was Show Me the Way. So there you go.
Two beautiful, absolutely beautiful songs. Okay, two last questions and I'll let you go. What was it like to go from a star? You left Humble Pie, you're on your own, you produced four albums, good albums, great albums, and then you produced Frampton Comes Alive. And you went from a star to the biggest name in rock and roll, a household name, absolute superstar. Over a period of a couple of weeks, what was that like? Can you even explain it?
Well, obviously, it was very, very exciting, but it was scary at the same time because it was massive. I never experienced anything like that up until that point. Even with Humble Pie having a gold record, with their live record, I never experienced what was going on with me, and so it was. In the future, if this were possible, I'll always have a number two hit rather than a number one hit, because number one gets all the attention and has to do all this publicity. And number two is picking up the nice chicks in the corner of the room, you know, so they don't bother about number two. So, but it was a surreal period for me. I've never experienced anything like that.
Yeah, I bet. Okay. And you say in your book that you made a few decisions you regret after that, and that's understandable. Maybe we could end by having you give some advice to our listeners. As you know, a bunch of neurologists, thousands of neurologists listen. Some are younger, some are older. Any advice that you give them, especially the younger neurologists as they embark on their career?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I don't have the schooling they have. I'm a dropout. I don't know whether I have these very, very worldly wise and educated doctors.
You have life lessons. So you must have some life lessons.
I mean, I applaud all of you for what you do. And some days must be very sad. And I don't know. Well, if we look at COVID, you know, the medical profession are at their wits' end, you know, and I feel for them. And it must be so hard for neurologists to have to give a diagnosis that isn't as good as mine. I applaud them, and I don't know how they can do it and without getting personally involved in a situation. That must be so difficult, and power to you.
Okay, thank you so much for your time. Peter, I wish you the best in life, especially as you continue to battle occlusion body myositis. Thank you very much.
No, thank you very much. I've enjoyed this.
Welcome, everyone. My name's Gordon Smith. I'm a professor and chair of neurology at VCU, and I have the immense pleasure of being able to interview Amy So, who's the lead author on a position paper from the American Academy of Neurology about drug costs. Dr. So, thanks for taking time to talk with us today about this hugely important topic. And I wonder if maybe you can begin by just talking a bit about how runaway drug costs impact both patients, but also neurologists. This is something you talk a lot about in the paper.
Thanks, Gordon. I'm so glad to have the chance to talk about this important issue. You know, I think we've all felt the impact of high drug prices on how we care for patients. I mean, first and foremost, you know, runaway drug costs have meant fewer patients can afford them. So one in four Americans report trouble for paying for drugs. And to deal with this, patients sometimes skip doses or take less, obviously not something that we as neurologists want to happen. You know, for neurologists, I think sorting through the restrictions that insurance or health systems have for expensive drugs can be really complicated. And getting a patient a drug we think they need can require a lot of paperwork and phone calls. So I came across one survey actually in which physicians said that they submitted 31 prior authorization requests a week. And a good chunk of doctors felt that these sorts of requirements had actually contributed to patients having, you know, a serious adverse event. So it's an important issue.
Yeah, it's interesting, Amy. I mean, I often think a lot about the financial toxicity of drug costs, out-of-patient costs on our patients, and you talk about this in the paper. And I think the point that there's neurotoxicity, and that I mean toxicity to neurologists because of drug costs, is really important to think about as well. I wonder if we can shift a little bit. You actually spent a lot of time in the paper talking about the ethical implications of drug costs viewed through distributive justice, which is a really great perspective. I wonder if you could define distributive justice and talk about how this concept applies here.
Yeah, sure. You know, I'm glad you asked. So distributive justice is, you know, one of the core ethical principles and is really concerned, you know, with asking, what do we think is a fair way of distributing resources and burdens across society? And, you know, I think, you know, when people think about ethics and medicine, a lot of times, you know, the issues that are coming to mind, you know, things like informed consent or how do we resolve disagreements about treatment, you know, these are focused on interactions between individual doctors and patients. And one of the things that I think really struck me about making this issue of high drug prices distinctive is that a lot of the main actors are actually outside of this traditional doctor-patient relationship. So I'm talking about industry, payers, pharmacy benefit managers, health systems, and how we have chosen to pay for healthcare in this country. So when we can think about, you know, this issue through the lens of distributive justice, I think the problem is not only that patients might not be getting access to certain expensive drugs that they need, but that the infrastructure, the policies that are created to restrict access to these drugs really can consume other valuable resources, things like our time. And, you know, I think it's really important for doctors to realize it's not just dollars at stake, but the amount of time that we, you know, we have to spend with patients. I don't know about you, but I think most of us already feel like, you know, we don't have enough time to get things done in clinic. And, you know, as we were putting this statement together, I was surprised to learn that neurologists actually have the second highest rate of burnout across medical specialties. One survey found that these burnout rates could be as high as 60%. Now, obviously, you know, a lot of things can be playing a role here, but, you know, there was at least one qualitative study that found that, you know, people called out insurance mandates and prior authorization requirements as things that contributed to this.
Yeah, such a huge issue for our field. And obviously, we could do many hours talking about burnout. And I think the intersection, you already talked a bit about the neurology toxicity of this, is something that's really important to neurologists and their team members. I think of the concept of distributive justice as being close in this area to that of opportunity cost. So the idea here is, if you give a patient a drug that costs $1 million, you could give 10 patients a drug that costs $100,000, or you could fund a homeless clinic for a very long period of time, which is related to the concept of rationing, which is a term people really hate to talk about in healthcare, but it happens whether explicit or implicit. You do a great job of discussing that. Can you talk a little bit about how our health system currently rations access to pharmaceutical treatments? And here I'm thinking those that are really expensive.
Yeah, you know, I think I completely agree that most people, myself included, often get uncomfortable when you hear the word rationing. But I think as COVID has so painfully reminded us, rationing is very much present. As you said, I think if we can think about it, we actually encounter forms of rationing in medicine on a daily basis. So who's getting insurance coverage? What drugs are available within a given health plan? How many hoops have to be jumped through to get a particular drug? How much a patient is actually going to pay in out-of-pocket costs? And even things that I think people don't sometimes think about, like how long does it take to get an appointment? And how much time do doctors get to spend with each patient? And these are all different forms of rationing. And I think it's really important for us as neurologists to recognize this, because it's important for us to ask, who is making the rules about how these resources are rationed? And to go back to the question of distributive justice, you know, do we think those rules are fair?
So maybe we can shift and talk a little bit about the pharmaceutical industry and how it operates. You point out that this is not a free market economy. Kind of the Byzantine nature of the system that you pointed out earlier, I think, is a reflection of that. You know, clearly, after FDA approval, companies get a period of market exclusivity. So by definition, not a free market economy. What is striking are the number of ways that companies try and extend this. And you talk about a couple pay for delay, which I think most of our listeners will be familiar with, but you also talk about product hopping, which is kind of seems to me similar to evergreening. I wonder, could you explain what that last one is, product hopping?
Yeah, sure. So I actually, this is something that I didn't know about until I was researching and working on this position statement. So, you know, as you mentioned, drug companies are understandably keen to avoid having to compete with a generic drug. Some research has actually found, you know, if there are two generic versions of a drug, the brand name price drops on average about 55%. And product hopping is one strategy companies can use when a generic's about to come on the market. So a company can take an existing brand name drug, make some small minor tweaks, and get a new patent. And then they can encourage patients to switch to the new version with, you know, an ad campaign, and then discontinue the older version. And, you know, one example of this that got some attention involved the drug Namenda. Shortly before a generic was due to come on the market, the company actually released an extended release version, so Namenda XR, which apparently had a different number of daily doses, but no difference in active ingredients or efficacy. And they launched it with a big ad campaign. And then soon afterwards, they discontinued the earlier version. So that's product hopping.
Yeah, kind of depressing. So maybe this is a good point where we can talk about potential solutions. And a lot here, probably very important area, a lot of conversation about value-based pricing models. And you talk about several approaches to this. And I was particularly struck by the subscription-based model that the state of Louisiana is using. You liken it to Netflix. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. This is a great story. So you could probably tell I'm like a health policy nerd. So, you know, many people might remember that starting around 2013, there were just a bunch of new hepatitis C treatments that were highly effective that started to come onto the market. And I think sofosbuvir was the first one. And these drugs worked really well, but they were super expensive. I think, you know, a course of treatment for sofosbuvir, you know, was estimated to cost around like $84,000 at that time. So, you know, the quandary that states had was, you know, how do we cover this medication while managing the budget? And Louisiana was actually the first to experiment with this subscription-based model, which some have called the Netflix model for their Medicaid plan. So instead of paying, you know, a separate fee for each patient that got the drug, the state actually made an agreement with a specific drug manufacturer that they would pay a flat subscription fee per month for an unlimited supply of the drug. So this allowed Louisiana to have a predictable monthly cost that they could spread over time, Well, in exchange, the drug manufacturer was guaranteed an income stream and also market exclusivity within the state. So, you know, a neat policy solution. And I think recently another state, Washington, has also moved to try this model.
It's so exciting to see innovation, isn't there? And hopefully these sort of interesting approaches will have an economy of scale, and we'll see more and more of them as we go forward.
Absolutely.
So how, and what about our patients, right? I mean, these are issues very important to patients. I really believe in kind of having conversations with patients about financial toxicity. As you pointed out, it's very common that patients abandon prescriptions or don't take as many of their medicines as they ought to take because of healthcare costs. What advice do you have about engaging patients in this process, both surrounding individual financial toxicity discussions, but also engaging our patients in the larger societal issues?
This is so important, Gordon. I completely agree that one of the key things that we as neurologists can do is to openly discuss the issue of costs with patients, you know, when we're talking about new prescriptions. I actually think some patients may feel uncomfortable raising the issue. So, you know, it's doubly important for us to be willing to bring it up and to consider potential alternatives, you know, when we're making these decisions along with patients. But, you know, I think one of the key points I hope people will take home is that, you know, those individual conversations that we have with our patients are really important and, you know, can make an impact. But, you know, our ability to care for patients is so impacted by, you know, these larger structural policies, some of which we've talked about, like how prices are set and how coverage is determined and what the rules are. So, you know, I'd argue that I hope neurologists and patients should consider becoming advocates for systems level policy change. And I really hope that we as neurologists can start to see this as connected to, you know, our mission of providing good care. You know, I really hope that people will be convinced that supporting efforts to address these systems issues and finding ways to bring policy level changes to these problems is really a vital way to provide good care for our patients. And I hope folks will come away feeling motivated to be involved.
Yeah, I mean, I so agree with you. I think this is really critical. Our path to progress in drug pricing can't be driven just by neurologists arguing about pharmaceutical company behavior. It really involves engaging all stakeholders, particularly our patients. You know, I all the time, for instance, tell my patients who are interested in this about patients for affordable drug, you know, David Mitchell's group, and the opportunity for them to tell their stories. So I think that's really, really important. One final question I'd like to talk about is that of fairness in drug pricing, which is really a different concept as opposed to value. And one aspect of fairness that, you know, I think about and sometimes struggle with that I'm hoping you can help me with is that of externality. That concept being that a innovative first-in-class drug might justify a higher price than individual patient-based value analysis, sort of like an ICER analysis might dictate, because the societal value of developing the first RNAi therapy is really important to spur further advances. So you know, the ODA kind of endeavors to do this through its prolonged period of exclusivity, I suppose. What are the ethics of this sort of concept of externality?
Well, it's a really good question and a difficult one. And I'll just preface this by saying, I'm going to disappoint you. I don't think I have the silver bullet, the right answer that can solve this problem definitively. I do think, though, that from an ethical perspective, it's important to consider what value-based analyses can tell us about what a drug offers. But we have to balance that with, I guess, the societal interest in making sure that there's enough incentive for companies to want to continue to research and develop innovative treatments like Zolgensma for rare diseases. So, you know, I think it's really going to be, it's really sort of a balancing act. And, you know, on the one hand, I think most folks would agree that drug prices have gotten out of hand for a lot of drugs, and we need to find ways to make those prices more fair. But on the other hand, we want to recognize the importance of making sure that there's enough incentives for companies to want to continue to research and innovate in these spaces, because that is important for our patients as a whole.
Well, Amy, I don't know. That's as close to a silver bullet answer as I think one could have, and a great way to end this. This has been great. I wish they would let us keep talking, but I suppose there are other topics that are going to be included in the podcast. So thank you so much for talking about your paper on behalf of the AAN's Ethics, Law, and Humanities Committee, Ethical Perspectives on Costly Drugs and Healthcare, AAN Position Statement. I'd like to thank you and all of your colleagues on the committee for your hard work and for this really outstanding paper, which I hope everyone will have a chance to read.
Thanks so much. It's been my pleasure. Thank you for highlighting this really important issue.
This is Jose Merino. Please check out this week's journal, which features an article that examines the satisfaction of current symptom control amongst patients with myasthenia gravis, as well as a study investigating clinical and imaging features associated with early neurologic deterioration in patients with lacunar stroke. Take a look at this and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.